Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Monday, March 30th. Now, lessons from China on surviving lockdown in your personal life, how lockdown helped China slow the spread and begin to reopen, and an argument for everyone wearing masks. Our guest is Eunice Yoon, Beijing bureau chief for CNBC, senior correspondent for NBC News, and host of their program Inside China. Hello from New York, Eunice. Thanks for coming on with us again. Can you hear us over there?
Yeah, I can. Thanks for having me, Brian.
That's great. Sometimes the line is better to Beijing than to Brooklyn. Can you give us the context for your reporting on lockdown? Were you locked down?
Oh yeah. Definitely lockdown in Beijing. So the first lockdown was in Wuhan, obviously the epicenter, and that was on January 23rd. And then a couple days later in Beijing and in the rest of the country, we just started hearing more and more travel restrictions or just movement restrictions. For example, for myself, the residential compound that I had that I live in, you started seeing more temperature checks. Then when you want to go into the subway, people were wearing hazmat suits. They wouldn't let you go into the subway unless you wore a mask. As the days progressed, things got a little bit more onerous. So eventually what we're living with now is that within my own compound, each apartment is only allowed three permits that we had to get with, your passport and also a proof that you actually live within the residential compound. And if you have four family members in the very beginning, that fourth family member wouldn't be able to leave the house. So it was that strict in the beginning. It's starting to loosen up because the situation has improved, but it was, definitely a lockdown.
And to what degree, for example, how did everyone get food during lockdown?
Well, in Beijing, it wasn't as strict compared to, say, the epicenter in Wuhan, because we were allowed to go to supermarkets that were within our residential compounds, or you could leave your residential compound with the correct permits, and then you could go get something from the supermarket and then come back into your house. But in Wuhan, it was very, very severe. So they were, the residents there were forced to live in their homes. They were locked into their houses, and they would rely on community authorities who would then present a certain set menu or something that they could buy from the grocery store. And then they would have to rely on those people who were very overwhelmed to be able to service all the various people within the community. And that actually became a major problem for Wuhan residents, especially in the beginning, because there were situations where their lockdown was such that they weren't even allowed to drive private cars within the city. So there were people who were sick in their houses and they couldn't take them to the hospital. So you would have to call on one of these community organizers to try to take you to the hospital. And then sometimes these people would be waiting for days. And then you had a situation where a lot of people were dying in their houses. And it started to improve over time, but it was a really big problem for Wuhan in the beginning.
And if people were sick in Wuhan, but didn't need hospitalization, were they taken to quarantine hotels?
Well, so in the early days, the people's understanding of the disease was not very good. So when people started getting sick, they would start going to the hospitals. And one of the major problems with Wuhan is that their hospitals were just getting overwhelmed. And in the beginning, because there were just so many people going to the hospitals, the doctors were turning people away and saying, well, if you have mild cases, then just some mild symptoms, just go home. And the problem with that was that people, when they would go home, were not isolating themselves. So it started, and it's a very infectious illness, as you know, so it started to infect entire families. And you started getting situations where five, six people in one family would all have coronavirus, and then multiple people would die at one time. So it became the, it was just this nightmare scenario. Mm-hmm. And so then after several days and over the weeks into February, there was a realization that they needed to, that the authorities needed to isolate patients. So they started to categorize people. And that's when you started seeing the hospitals that were built up. And confirmed cases would go to those hospitals. Then there were pop-up clinics that would pop, you know, that were being created. And then they would have people who were confirmed, but mild cases would go there. And then finally, they also would have their suspected cases go to centralized quarantine. And it was only after they started really categorizing people that you started to see the numbers significantly drop.
Do the experts there think that measures to that degree are necessary in New York, which is the new epicenter now that Wuhan is largely getting this under control?
So in terms of the, for example, the restrictions in Wuhan, there have been a bunch of people here who've discussed whether or not a quarantine made sense here in Wuhan. And I know that you guys are having a similar debate about, or at least that there was an idea that New York could be quarantined. And I think that with Wuhan, it was seen as something that came in too late and also wasn't very effective at all, because the public transportation was cut off, the flights were cut off, but people could still go in and out of the city. And then it actually had a detrimental effect, because when the lockdown was announced in Wuhan, a lot of people got scared and tried to flee the city. And later we heard the mayor announce just several days later that 5 million people had left Wuhan. Part of that was because of which is about half of the population of the city. And that part of that was because of the Lunar New Year holiday, but also part of that was because people got really scared and then they wanted to get out. So that's exactly the opposite of what you'd want to have when you intend to quarantine a city. And then the other issue was that sitting in Beijing, I would talk to a lot of Chinese colleagues and friends, and it's just had this emotional damage effect on people outside of Wuhan, because a lot of people would you'd see all these stories coming out of Wuhan of people just, you felt like the city was fighting to save itself, and that and that has a psychological effect and a negative one on the rest of the country.
So you have this article called "It's Not Impossible to Live Under a Coronavirus Lockdown," and we'll get to some specifics. But your frame is that it gets better. Gets better how?
Well, it does get better because part of it is that you start to adjust. You get used to living with a lockdown, and you do, you do feel like after a while that the numbers that were jumping so quickly in the beginning start to come down, because you are practicing social distancing. You are making sure that you're doing the right things, and that actually does feel better. So that's one of the main things. And especially if you're careful about washing your hands or not touching your face and all of these things that are very, very simple, but still have a big effect.
Let's go through some of the particulars in your article, maybe tick, tick, tick briefly on a few of these. Like you wrote about how you enter your home after being outside. You write, you don't have to get naked in the garage, but you've been doing a lot of laundry. What's your practice there?
Yeah, so that was also someone else had asked me if they needed to get completely undressed before they got into the house. And so I said, no, that's not necessary. But I do make sure that I'm constantly doing laundry a lot more than before. And part of that is because there's been so many studies now about how long the virus can last on different surfaces and then in the air. And so nothing is totally conclusive, but the what people are kind of basing their action on is a study now that came out of the CDC, which is that the virus lives on surfaces, especially hard ones, between 2 to 3 days, on cardboard for 24 hours, fabrics that wasn't on there, but the assumption is that it's more similar to cardboard. And so so because of that, it's just that you're, for me, and I think a lot of people here, you're always aware that you can be bringing in viruses into your house. So you want to have a disinfectant protocol as you enter your house. And so the person who, and you know, in this more strict times, there were a lot of people who had just one person designated, and this was a government decision in a lot of times, or authorities, local authorities, but that they would have just one person allowed, or you know, two people allowed out of the house, depending on where you were. And so those people would usually have the disinfection protocol.
And you mentioned that in the kitchen, you let dishes dry completely after washing. What does that do?
Yeah. Well, just because if you have water sitting in there, you don't know what else. I mean, this is me personally. I just don't want to have water sitting and then the potential for bacteria to collect. But I think what a lot of restaurants have been doing is using a higher temperature to wash dishes. So I think in the U.S., a lot of people have dishwashers. So that is a way to sanitize your dishes. But, you know, in China, it's not as common to have a dishwasher. So I personally just wash my dishes at a very hot temperature, as hot as I can actually tolerate it. And then I just allow my dishes to dry completely.
My guest is Eunice Yoon, CNBC's Beijing Bureau Chief. And now we get to the masks. You tweeted the other day, I would have N95 masks for everyone on Earth if I could. But I also know when I started reporting on the virus, I was reusing the same anti-dust mask and carrying a bar of soap in a box in my purse till supplies came in. It's not perfect, but it doesn't have to be paralyzing. That was your tweet.
Yeah,
so Eunice, when and where do you use masks?
I wear a mask all the time. So the only time I'm not wearing a mask is when I'm in the house. And otherwise, in China mandated that everyone in the epicenter in Wuhan had to wear a mask. And then it was strongly advised for the rest of the country. But in China, that essentially means that it's mandated. So everybody wears a mask. And part of it is also... when you don't wear a mask, you get scolded. You know, I was in a park several weeks ago, and I thought, oh, there's not that many people around. I could take my mask off. And then I pulled the mask down, and then a police officer came over and he scolded me. So they want to make sure that they break any possibility of the virus spreading to each other and so that there really isn't a whole lot of wiggle room for it.
You know, in this country, there's just the beginning now of a masks for all campaign. And we've been told that ordinary masks, not the N95s, which are for healthcare workers, but the ones that anybody used to be able to buy in a drugstore, lots of places. We've been told that those ordinary masks are for the sick, not the healthy, because they stop the virus more from going out than coming in. But that may be changing, because I see you tweeted a recommendation from the CDC for consumers, yes, to wear cotton masks with guidelines on how to make them ourselves from household items. So the Centers for Disease Control is now saying that?
Well, it was a U.S., a former FDA commissioner. And
it was an individual, not an official government recommendation.
Yeah, but there has been a lot more discussion now, I see, in the United States about how, from a more official level, about the benefits of people wearing masks. And the reasoning here was that, first of all, in Asia more broadly, but in China, it's not unusual for people to wear masks. Part of it is because of pollution. Part of it is because when people get sick, they just put on a mask. It's not really a big deal. Also, there's a very strong memory of the SARS outbreak, even though it was 17 years ago. So across Asia, people generally feel more comfortable putting on a mask, and there's nothing seen as strange about it. So But then I think there's a belief that this could actually be beneficial. And I think in the U.S., you're starting to see that even though it's not perfect to wear a mask, there is some recognition that it could help. And because of the unknown nature of this virus, I mean, one of the things that people have been talking about here is if it's airborne. And again, the CDC had said that it could be airborne for up to 3 hours. And in China, there have been studies that showed it could be airborne for even longer than that. And it's not to scare anybody, because with those ones that were longer were in very, very very specific circumstances, like when you're in a bus and there are no windows open or something like that. But because of that, and because people can be asymptomatic, the feeling here was just everybody wear a mask, just because it just seemed like a safer thing to do.
Let's take a phone call. TK in Rockland County, you're on WNYC. Hi, TK.
Hey, good morning, everybody. I'm just trying to find out what I can do to keep my family safe. I work part-time at FedEx, and most people that work at FedEx work part-time. So we really don't have any health care, per se. They're not giving us anything, okay? We're in trucks, unloading, touching boxes. There's no way we're 6 feet apart inside that truck. I'm not even talking about delivery, because normally they're alone. I'm talking about the people that are unloading and loading these trucks that are coming in from all across the country and the world. Okay? And so what can we do to protect our family? We're not getting hazard pay. We're not getting masks. We're not getting gloves. We're not getting anything.
TK, thank you. And we're going to stay on this particular question. Because you guys are the frontline workers right now. You guys are the ones who are deemed essential and have to put yourselves at risk. So, Eunice, how did they handle that in China with delivery people? How do they?
Well, for delivery people who are in Wuhan, they were dressed almost like hospital workers. They would have protective gear, like a full hazmat suit. They would wear goggles. They would have gloves. They would have masks for sure. And so that was in Wuhan, because the situation was so dire. For the rest of the country, just like everybody else here, masks are mandated. And so, or at least essentially mandated for the rest of the country. But for the healthcare workers, not the healthcare workers, for the frontline delivery people, they were always wearing masks. And it's even more strict for them because their companies require it. So, for me, I guess if I were delivering things, I would, the most important thing is to wash your hands. I know it sounds simple, but actually it's the most important thing, because you're touching things, but the way that the virus has been spreading the most has been through touch. So by touching different surfaces and then touching your eye or something like that. So as long as you're very aware of that, to me, that's the most important thing to remember. And then if in terms of social distancing, that's harder, because I don't know if there are two people in the truck. Then, I mean, in China, they would both be wearing masks. And I know that whenever I'm in a vehicle, I wear a mask, just because you don't know what what the other person in the car has been doing or not doing. Maybe if there's a way to be with somebody who you know their history. So, like, for example, when I'm traveling with my crew, we've always been together. We're always with each other. So even though it's not perfect, they might get sick from somebody else that they're having dinner with or something like that. At least for the most part, I know that that they're very careful about mitigating their own risk.
Where'd they get all those masks and hazmat suits, by the way? If you're talking about delivery people wearing hazmat suits in Wuhan, you know, maybe FedEx would be giving them out to people like our caller, but they're in short supply, not to mention masks.
Well, I think this was a major difference. And I think from looking at the way that, you know, the federal system in the United States, and then a much more centralized system in China. Of course, there are pros and cons, but in this particular situation, once the leadership realized that there was a problem, there was an all hands on deck kind of situation where suddenly you saw that manufacturers were just ordered to pump out masks. So in the beginning, a lot of people had masks anyway, just because it's, like I said, it's not unusual. But mm-hmm. then we were getting reports, constant reports and updates about how many masks they had. And actually now there is actually a quite a large supply of masks here, because there was a national decision. And I think that's something that is really different. I mean, there's pros and cons to that. I think what's interesting watching Governor Cuomo, I've been watching his press briefings, and you would never have a situation, especially in the beginning in Wuhan, with what he was doing, because he is able to, it just seems like he just made a decision, you know, that he is going to do this for New York. He's going to make decisions for New York. And in China, local officials, of course, in theory, are able to push ahead with certain initiatives and they can make some decisions. But a lot of times they can't or they won't, because they're waiting for the Beijing to make a decision. And so their strengths, I felt like in the U.S. system, there's a strength in that. You have a lot of states making decisions, and then they could make their own decisions, which is always good. The weakness of that system, and maybe the strength in Beijing, is that if a decision is made at the national level, everyone mobilizes.
Let me take one more caller for you, and our caller is Calder. Calder in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi, Brian. Hi, Ms. Yoon. I called in late January on one of the earlier segments you guys had about this situation, and I asked about the differences between an authoritarian government's response to a pandemic versus an open democracy like our own. And at the time, I think mostly we had thought China was keeping it under control, and we didn't really anticipate how serious it was going to get here. But I was wondering if you could speak to that from your perspective as a Beijing bureau chief and correspondent. And then my second question is, as a New York City resident, I can't help but feeling this visceral, irrational reaction to how the rest of the country and the media is portraying the situation in New York, the way political games are playing with our livelihoods and our future. And the only thing I can compare it to is how I felt in high school when we went to war in Iraq off the back of that horrible attack on September 11th. And I'm just wondering if you could speak to those two issues.
Calder, thank you so much. Eunice, and then we're out of time.
Well, so for an authoritarian government versus a more free market one, I think that in China, you see the pros of the centralized part is that when Beijing decides to mobilize, they mobilize. And one major difference that you saw that you don't see happening in New York and that you saw for Wuhan is that once Beijing realized that there was a crisis in Wuhan, they did mobilize all the resources to that one area, which I think is what Governor Cuomo is trying to do or has hoped to do. To me, it looks like Governor Cuomo is calling on volunteers to try to beef up the backup healthcare workers. But in China, they sent in the military, and there were tens of thousands of people from all over the country that were all the doctors and medical workers that they could spare were going into the province and specifically into Wuhan. So that, to me, is a benefit of having a centralized decision-making system. However, there are major problems with the top-down and authoritarian approach, and that is that at the very beginning, doctors were suppressed. They had the information at hand, and then they weren't allowed to tell even their own colleagues. And so that became a major problem where you started to see, for example, the ER in the hospitals and the respiratory departments, those people, because they were aware of it and were telling their own colleagues, just put on a mask, just wear this protective gear. The most severe cases were not in those departments because they were at least told. But people who were eye doctors in cancer, you know, in oncology, all the other departments, they were never informed. And so the death rate was really high. Healthcare workers were were getting sick very quickly, and that's because information was suppressed. And I think that if that information hadn't been suppressed, you could say that there might never have been a pandemic at all. Mm-hmm. So there's pros and cons to the systems.
Well, this has been so informative and I think really helpful for a lot of Americans just starting to deal with what you've been going through for a while there. Eunice Yoon, senior correspondent for NBC News and the Beijing bureau chief for CNBC, thank you so much. Stay safe.
Thank you so much. You too.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is obviously also a daily coronavirus podcast under the circumstances in our country right now. We'll keep staying on top of things to serve you the best we can. And remember, this podcast is excerpted from my live weekday call-in show, The Brian Lehrer Show. If you want to be a caller or just hear it live, it's from 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time on WNYC Radio in New York, or online at WNYC.org. You can also tweet a question at us anytime. Just tweet at Brian Lehrer. Thanks for listening today.